the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we are going to discuss the latest information on the Israel-Palestine conflict and we're going to consider, is a ceasefire likely to hold and what role can the United States play to make it a more stable region and certainly a better opportunity for both Palestinians and Israelis? And what are the underlying causes of the most recent hostilities? For example, is there a case of political opportunism in play by the government of Israel? And is there a case of disproportional defence that has been in play? And if so, does this amount to crimes? And if so, what global body is able to consider such allegations? And is the Palestine's Fatah party a party of the past? And will Hamas survive Israel's intent to destroy it? Also, halfway through the program, we're going to discuss Samoa and the political constitutional crisis. For example, how did Samoa get to this? And where does Samoa stand now as a principled member of the Pacific Island Forum? Okay, so let's cross to Paul right now to discuss this, these issues, and more. Good afternoon, Paul.
Tanakwe, Selwyn, and nau mai to all of our audience out there.
Ka pai, Paul, and kia ora to you too. Paul, so first off, let's have a look at the Israel conflict and also where we are now. You know, we've seen this week the United States perhaps tidy up a lot of the confusing messages that were coming out while the conflict was raging over in Palestine and the Gaza Strip in particular. This week we've seen the diplomatic efforts kick into gear, pushing the United Nations to a degree to this side, and we've seen Secretary of State Blinken arriving in the territory, in Israel, having a bilateral meeting with Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. What's this all about, Paul? Can you take us through? And also, perhaps, let's go into this deeper so that we can see in some ways what is really at the heart and the bedrock of this conflict that seems to be enduring through the decades.
Well, thanks a lot for allowing me the opportunity to step back a little bit and put my comparative politics hat on, because I think what's been missing from a lot of the analyses is some of the underlying factors, you know, not just the long history of Israel-Palestinian relations, but contemporary history that is not being examined. So there are three angles that I think that we need to consider when reviewing this latest conflict or this latest round of conflict. The first one is that it's a classic example of the dangers of weak political leadership. Benjamin Netanyahu is in a very weak position. He's had four elections in the last 2 years in which he's not been able to form a stable government. And he was under siege before he decided to respond to rock throwing in Jerusalem with these very, well, I'm going to correct myself. Hamas started launching rockets after the Israelis responded with disproportionate force to the rock throwing, and that gave Netanyahu the excuse to, you know, bomb them. So Hamas took the bait, but I'll get to that in a second. The point is Netanyahu was in a weak political position, but so too is the Palestinian Authority. Fatah, the party that runs the Palestinian Authority, only controls the West Bank, and its leader, Mahmoud Abbas, is as corrupt as the day is long. And he's been in power for about 20 years. The de facto rulers of Gaza are Hamas, who, for whatever terrorist label they are given, and to be sure, they have committed terrorist acts, they are more honest in the treatment of the people of Gaza than Fatah is in the treatment of the West Bank. And here's where things get interesting. The youth in the West Bank have had it with Fatah and Abbas. They're done. There's been a generational change, and you now have the makings of another intifada by a generation of people who weren't around for the previous one. So
this sounds like it's kind of symptomatic of weak leadership on the Israel government side, with its prime minister obviously
and
facing...
And the Palestinian Authority
side.
Yeah,
that's what I'm going to... say. So you've got an intersection of two situations where there's weak leadership. There are allegations of corruption on both sides here, yeah, with respect to Netanyahu having to face charges, and he's politically in a weak position, couldn't bring about a stable government prior to this conflict actually being sparked. The opportunities weren't presenting to him in a sense how he would like. There was no violence coming across from the Palestinian side, for example. Next thing, there is extreme moves on the holy sites in Jerusalem that we had Israeli forces going in there, asserting inside the holy site while people are praying, extensive forces, tear gas being led on. All of this that sparks a response. So that's the backstory to the most recent example, not to mention up in the West Bank, the settler issues and advancing Israel's interests more and more and expelling Palestinians from their own legitimate homes. So all of this is the most recent spark. And it seems to me, if you were looking at it, that Israel was looking for an opportunity. In some ways, a cynic or even a realist politically could say they created the opportunity where Hamas would retaliate in some way. It did happen, and the rest in the last 2 weeks has been history, isn't it? People are
right.
Dead.
Given the recent context, again, the displacement of six Palestinian families from their ancestral homes by settlers, all that in the buildup. And then, of course, you have the holiest day of the year, Eid, Friday prayers, and the Israelis decide to hold a memorial service for their war dead below the Al-Aqsa Mosque and elsewhere in Jerusalem. And they send the police up to the mosque to cut off the loudspeakers because they're afraid that the call to prayers will drown out the speech-making further down the hill. There was no need to do that. There was absolutely no need to do that. But they decided they would do it because they knew what was going to happen. And here's, again, this weak leadership syndrome, because it is a syndrome. They decide that they have to show strength. And so they do these sort of things. Abbas and Fatah are powerless to control their people in the West Bank because they have no legitimate authority anymore. Let's remember, they canceled an election that they were going to lose to Hamas. And so Hamas steps into the breach and launches rockets into Israel to claim, I would say, its rightful position as the leadership, not just of Gaza, but of the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. They're making now a belligerent move, not so much to provoke the Israelis, although it got a reaction, but to show this new generation of Palestinian youth in the West Bank that they are the true leaders. And so then we get the conflict. But let me tell you two other things, and I'll make it brief. The second part of this is that, in a sense, all of the main players are trapped by their own histories, that they feel compelled to respond, even though better judgment would advise restraint and moderation. And one way to look at it is the following. The Israelis have claimed to have won many military victories against Hamas. And if you go into kill ratios and proportion of damage, then the Israelis certainly have emerged, quote unquote, victorious from every single fight they've had with Hamas. However, this fight has been going on for 30 years without a resolution. Now, if you think that wars are fought to achieve political objectives, and wars that do not achieve the intended political objectives are failures, then for all the military victories the Israelis have won, they have lost the war. Hamas is still standing. It is still fighting. It's garnering more support with the younger generation, which ensures that there'll be more fighting ahead. So what is the point? What is the point other than...
It's been a failed exercise. So there's a third point that you have as well, isn't there, that leads to perhaps giving a rationale on this. So there are failed reasons, failed outcomes from on behalf of the Israel government. What's this third point?
Oh, the point simply was that if you're fighting feudal wars that do not resolve the political problem, and I admit it's a very thorny political problem, then all you're engaging is in tit-for-tat bloodletting to score immediate opportunistic points with your own audience. You're not teaching, the Israelis are not teaching Hamas a lesson. Hamas is not teaching Israel a lesson. Hamas has the advantage because everything they're doing is positioning themselves better when it comes to the competition with Fatah for overall control of the Palestinian Authority. As far as Israel is concerned, as an editorial in one of its leading newspapers stated last week, this has all been futile. It's all about trying to preserve Netanyahu and has nothing to do with the defense of Israel. That is a political solution. So one of the things that I saw, and you may be bringing a clip up that will illustrate this, is the United States, of course, continues to support Israel, at least in public, doesn't even want to criticize them. The Secretary of State, who I have some respect for, goes to Israel to talk, have a chat fest with Netanyahu. The hard fact is this. Just like whether you like it or not, Israel is here to stay. Just like whether you like it or not, North Korea is here to stay. The fact is Hamas is here to stay. Hamas is not going anywhere. And so whether you ignore them or not, they will be a political factor in any solution to this very intractable Palestine-Israeli problems, as it is. And if I'm going to put any rationality into it, I would simply say, well, this is all about jockeying for position. Hamas vis Fatah and Israel vis the Palestinians as a whole, using a carrot and stick approach, although all I see right now is carrot, where the settlements begin and then are withdrawn. There's these various skirmishes and what have you, and some sort of middle ground, again, I can't visualize it at this point, begins to emerge from the debris. If that's the case, there is some rationality, but right now, this whole thing is an exercise in futility, with the exception of the position of Hamas, which undoubtedly has been fortified and strengthened as a result of this latest round.
Yeah. So, one of the interesting things that comes out of this this news clip from Al Jazeera that we're about to play, I think, and what way I saw this is that you've got the United States actually advancing this dialogue, this talk with Netanyahu, that the Palestinians have a right to their defense as well. They have a right to humanitarian respect, humanitarian aid, etc., etc. Well, you haven't seen this for some time. Certainly, this wouldn't have occurred in the Trump years. And so there seems to be a bit more packaging or placing Israel into a box of which the United States wants to define. We'll just play this this clip first with respect to the bilateral meeting with the Palestinians relating to aid, and then we'll go to the other one, and then we'll talk to you about what you make of it, Paul.
Arriving in Tel Aviv, the US Secretary of State on a trip with a narrow aim, keeping things calm after the ceasefire. His first stop, an audience with Israel's Prime Minister, pledging the US's continuing commitment to Israel's defense, but adding this.
We believe that Palestinians and Israelis equally deserve to live safely and securely, to enjoy equal measures of freedom, opportunity, and democracy, to be treated with dignity.
That echoed by the Israeli leader, his words perhaps unconvincing to some after leading an 11-day bombardment of Gaza.
We discussed also how to improve the lives and the conditions of the Palestinians, the humanitarian conditions.
In Ramallah, the first visit by a Secretary of State to the President of the Palestinian Authority for over 3 years, all contact was stopped when the Trump administration announced it was moving the US Embassy to Jerusalem. There was a cordial tone, but it was clear one of the President's central demands was not on the US agenda.
We hope that the future will be full of diplomatic activities in order to reach a comprehensive solution and to put an end to recent events.
President Abbas was told, though, that the US would reopen its consulate general in East Jerusalem, a diplomatic representation specifically for Palestinians, which was closed by President Trump. There was a commitment to help in the rebuilding of Gaza after the 11-day war and a new package of funding for the UN and the Palestinian Authority.
So that's pretty much it in a nutshell. The interesting parts to come out of that, Paul, I thought were the Netanyahu's response to Blinken's positions. It almost seemed like this was a different person. He certainly looks like he's been told how to respond in some ways, if you're looking at it from a distance here. How do you read that? What are the subtleties in the diplomacy that you're picking up?
Well, one of the arts of diplomacy is to be Janus-faced when talking to different audiences. And so the U.S. has come into this with a progressive wing in the Democratic Party that is openly claiming that the U.S. needs to put some distance on Israel, that Israel has gone from the underdog and the champion of Western values in the Middle East to being a bully, to be no better than its adversaries over the years. And there's some truth to that. Now, the Israel lobby in the United States remains very strong, but it's been undermined by particularly Netanyahu's actions in not stopping the settlements and disproportionately punishing the civilian Palestinian population for the sins of its leaders. And let's remember that under international law, collective punishment of populations for the actions of their leaders is illegal.
I was going to just say in there too, yeah, war crimes. Let's get into that in a few minutes. Allegations of international humanitarian law being breached, war crimes, et cetera, et cetera. If you looked at that element that was clearly in evidence last week and the week before, that yes, Israel, like the Palestinian territories, have every right to defend themselves, but the disproportionate attacks from the point of view of observing the retaliatory strikes by Israel with US-made hardware on a defenseless civilian population largely in a crowded area where they cannot, meaning the aggressors, the Israeli defense forces, cannot selectively take out facilities in Gaza without taking out huge numbers of civilians. And look at the proportion of children that were killed. You know, huge proportion of children. It's almost like once that sunk in last week, that the Biden administration kicked in, not through multilateral efforts, but bilateral efforts. And I'm very interested to see whether or not you believe that the pressure was not just from the Democratic faction, like Bernie Sanders led, for example, with about 29 signatories that were presented to Joe Biden to actually get on page with this, but a wider humanitarian effort amongst the population. And sorry, I picked up a change of nuance, if you like, or the mood in the United States press where Palestinians were not spoken of, for example, up in the West Bank, the retaliations by the youth, mainly with stones and slingshots. They were spoken of as protesters, not as terrorists. And that was an indication perhaps that things were changing in the United States with respect to the pressures that would ultimately go on the administration. Paul, that's how I saw it, a week of change diplomatically. Is that correct? Is that got some merit to it? Or is that a bit of a diversion away and perhaps overly hopeful?
Well, you are very hopeful, but there has been a shift in perceptions. Again, Israel has managed to squander over the years the immense goodwill in the West towards it, again, as the underdog, and that it's no longer the underdog. It's the military giant of the Middle East. And it's very belligerent out of proportion to the threats that exist against it. I mean, if they claim that they got two existential threats. One is Iran, and even though I disagree with that, I can see their point. The other one is Hamas and the radicalized Palestinian population. And I would say, well, unless you subscribe to that replacement theory where the birth rates of Palestinians will outstrip those of Jews, and Israel will become not only an Arab-majority country, which it basically is now, but that they will be subjugated under future Arab leadership. Unless you believe that, then Hamas is certainly not a military equal. Fatah is nowhere. I was going to say, you know, this guy Abbas is part of the problem. He's not part of the solution. And so I think that, again, they're trapped in their own histories. And the United States, along with many European powers, and then just think about the reaction here in New Zealand, we don't have a dog in that fight. And so I would say that from my observations, most people are sympathetic to the Palestinians because we're a small country. We don't like bullies, you know, that sort of thing. The Palestinians are the new underdogs. I mean, there's been a reversal in roles. And the United States,
over,
I think,
over about 20 to 30 years.
This hasn't been overnight. This has not been overnight. And I would say to you that if Israel and Iran moved into open conflict, a lot of people would still support Israel because the narrative in the West against Iran is overwhelmingly negative. You know, it just is. Again, I tend to disagree with that narrative on a number of grounds, but I could see that. But when it comes to Israel and Palestine, the continual encroachment on and stealing of Palestinian land by Orthodox Jewish settlers. And here's another point. These settlers are not native Israelis. They're coming from overseas. They're Americans, they're Russians, they're British, and obviously they're all Zionists, but they are ultra-Orthodox in the main. And they do want to push the Palestinians into the sea. They do not see any chance of reconciliation. And quite frankly, with those sort of ideological views, there will be no resolution because, again, it's the elephant in the room. The Palestinians, you may starve them, you may bomb them, but they're not going anywhere. You know, they're not, and their representatives aren't. So I think that what you have in the United States is an extremely cautious, quite ideologically moderate administration after an absolute freak show under Trump. Yeah. And what they're slowly trying to do is nudge Israel into conciliatory positions. I noticed in the background when Ambassador Blinken was talking to Netanyahu, some of the people in the back of them were senior ranking security officials, including, I believe I saw, the head of the CIA. And so behind the scenes, I have a feeling there were some very pointed discussions about military aid, about proportionality in the response. Yeah. And let's be clear, I'm not
because Netanyahu's demeanor was quite different to this time last week, where he and his people were openly saying on the world stage, we will seek out Hamas wherever and we will destroy them. This is quite different. The word Hamas is not being used, but he's acknowledging the right of Palestinians to live in peace. That's not the Netanyahu we saw only a matter of days ago. So something has pushed him over. Yeah.
Well, that's why I say everybody was being Janus face, because when he talks to his own audience, his domestic audience, he's all fierce. When he talks to the United States and the court of world opinion, he starts softening. Although I think the softening had a lot to do with what was said behind closed doors. But let me make a clear point to our audience, lest they think we're all tilting in an anti-Israeli way. This does not absolve Hamas of indiscriminately firing missiles into Israel and killing civilians. Now, that's all they can do. They can't launch a land war. They don't have an air force with precision-guided munitions. So Hamas did what it had to do to make a point to Fatah, and Israel was the foil that it used to do it. But the launching of missiles into civilian areas in Israel is a war crime. Let's be clear. But Hamas is not recognized as a state actor. It's recognized as a terrorist entity. So they're not subject to the state.
There's two elements of it, though, isn't it? You know, one would say it's a legitimate political force, political party that has won elections in the past. And then, to me, when you look at that, in some ways, it's the same kind of equation, same kind of considerations or evaluations or analysis that was applied to Sinn Féin all those years ago. Sinn Féin had, So I think, you know, in the West, many, and particularly through mainstream media, will look at Hamas and see as one group. Whereas it's not quite the reality, is it? There's a political aspiration, a political wing. From your own analysis, it's showing that Fatah perhaps is not the party of which Yasser Arafat once led, that raised a generation's hopes with respect to getting statehood, et cetera, et cetera. That Fatah is out of the picture. It's a part of the old. It's not a part of the future or the solutions, perhaps. And that's where I think maybe a dialogue and analysis going down into the Hamas areas, particularly from the point of view of what it can bring beyond rockets going over into the civilian areas of Israel, would be productive and forward walking as opposed to static.
Listen, that comparison with Sinn Féin was excellent. And you know why? Because any military move by a subordinate actor open space for the political maneuvering. That's the point. You're opening space. And Hamas has a political arm. It's run by a guy called Yahya Sinwar. He lives in Gaza City, and the Israelis were trying to kill him. They bombed three different locations where he was supposedly at. Notice they did not go after the military commanders. The military commander for Hamas is in Qatar. And Qatar gives him safe haven, but let's say that the Mossad has the ability to reach out and touch people in brutal ways. They chose not to. They chose to try to kill the political leadership, which tells you that they understand the solution is political, not military. Yeah. And so I think that was an excellent analogy to draw, because eventually Hamas has to be recognized as the political movement that it is. And in the recognition, you probably will see a diminishing of the military operations, and particularly the ones that involve terroristic activities and war crimes, because the parties that are recognized that way become subject to the full international sanctions that go with state violations of international norms.
Let's look at that, Paul. In closing this part of the program with respect to Israel-Palestine conflict, what body exists today that can actually hear legitimate allegations of war crimes that may or have been committed against the people in Gaza?
The International Criminal Court.
So what about the fact that Israel is not a signatory, and the Palestinian territories not recognized as being able to or not willing to? Is that a fair assumption? And can other countries take any perpetrators of such crimes to the International Criminal Court on behalf of humanity?
Yes, there's two things that we need to consider, and I might point out that most of the Arab world are not signatories to the ICC Convention. What was called the Lisbon Agreement, which is only from 2004 or 5. I can't remember exactly.
And we should say the United States isn't either. Bill Clinton signed up as a signatory. George W. Bush vetoed that. Off
right,
the
exactly. I was just about to say the U.S. was not a signatory. But just because you're not a signatory, just because you don't recognize the ICC jurisdiction, doesn't mean that the ICC cannot investigate and bring indictments. And then it can issue an Interpol red alert, which is an arrest warrant, internationally speaking, for the arrest and detention and eventual prosecution of people identified as ordering or committing war crimes, which in this instance would include members of the Israeli high command and Netanyahu himself, as well as the Hamas leadership. And so I was thinking that if they did that, and again, this is within the realm of the possible, what would happen to Netanyahu, what would happen to his military leaders, let's say the head of the Air Force, the people who led the bombing campaign, but also the Hamas leadership, is they'd basically be reduced to the status of Augusto Pinochet, General Pinochet, when he went to London to visit Maggie Thatcher and an international arrest warrant was issued against him by the predecessor to the ICC for the crimes against humanity he committed against his own people. Pinochet wound up wasting away in a London mansion for over a year and then was spirited out back to Chile, where he died soon thereafter, because he couldn't move internationally. He couldn't take a commercial flight. He couldn't go anywhere. Right. If you issue a red alert against Netanyahu, to be fair, as well as against, you know, Sinwar and others, they're confined to quarters. You know, they cannot leave Israel or Gaza without being subject to arrest. Now, whether or not it's enforceable if Netanyahu flew to the United States, that's a matter of discussion. But imagine the embarrassment if the United States disregarded an Interpol red alert on Netanyahu. I mean, again, the complications to this, that could be a way, if not bringing them to justice, a way of deterring future such crimes.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Saying to them and others, I mean, you know, I'm grasping for solutions, but I think the ICC, which has successfully prosecuted the former Serbian leadership for their war crimes, yep, and crimes against humanity, that they are the agency to bring justice to the victims of both sides. And they should put all leaders who otherwise would violate international norms and the laws of war, that they're on notice that one way or another, they will be held accountable for the crimes that they order and commit.
I mean, just as we take a transition, we'll go transition and then we'll come back and talk in brief about Samoa's situation and whether or not it can actually maintain or retake that principled position that it once held very strongly in the Pacific Island Forum. Before we do, just for those, this is such a polarized issue between the Israeli state and obviously the Palestinian territories and its peoples. Where we sit on it is clearly from a humanitarian, political, and legal aspect, and that's what we've been analysing today, and the humanitarian elements of this whole issue have been what have been driving our concerns that you'll see expressed in the way we've handled this analysis on this program at this time, and we'll be revisiting this for sure in the coming weeks. So here's the transition. We'll be back with a discussion about Samoa. Welcome back. I'll just play a clip relating to the Samoan situation to bring viewers and audience up to speed with what has been happening there. And then Paul and I will have a solid discussion into what this means and where is Samoa placing itself from the point of view of the respect of its members in the Pacific, particularly the Polynesian side.
Fiume Naomi Mapa'afa took the oath of office in a tent outside Samoa's parliament. She was due to be sworn in inside as the island nation's first female prime minister, but was locked out by the parliamentary speaker.
Head of state didn't come. The legislative office locked the building, so we couldn't access it.
That's despite the Supreme Court ordering parliament to reconvene, the Chief Justice and fellow judges joining a march to the building, concerned the rule of law wasn't being followed. They were also kept out. And that's because this man, caretaker Prime Minister Tuele Epa Sailele Malealingaoi, who's been in office for 22 years, says the ceremony was unconstitutional.
At this time, there is only one government.
A custodian government.
But Tuila Epa is also refusing to be sworn in, saying a part of Samoa's constitution covering the number of women in parliament hasn't been observed. Analysts say it's because he doesn't have the numbers to lead.
I would say that it's weaponizing aspects of the constitution to maintain power. There was a free, fair and transparent election that happened in 9 April and members of parliament were elected. The people spoke and democracy was observed. It just hasn't been carried out.
So, Paul, with respect to Samoa, what are we seeing here? Is this just simply a fact where the old boys club that have been in power for decades are reluctant to hand over to a new party, to a Samoa's first woman elect, prime minister elect?
Well, this is a classic instance of disputed succession or disputed transition, Samoa style.
Was able.
What you basically have is a constitutional coup committed by Tuilaepa and his cronies to prevent the natural succession, the legitimate succession, to what used to be the opposition. You know, the FAST party is now the party of government, thanks to the one vote of the independent MP who swung it in their direction. And so the refusal to hand over power, to me, signifies two things. It signifies that after 25 some odd years, and the Human Rights Protection Party that Tuilaepa is the leader of, has basically dominated Samoan politics since 1982. He has been in government for 20 years plus. And it has blinded them. The perks of power have gone to their heads, and they don't realize that all this lip service to democracy at some point requires them to hand over power to the opposition. Let's remember, one of the hallmarks of democracy, political democracy, is rotation in office. That's considered intrinsically good because when oppositions come into office, they learn how to govern. And when governments go out of office, they know how to be a legitimate opposition. It also allows for refreshing and renewal within the ranks. So it's a natural process in democracies. And to try to stymie that process is like trying to stymie aging. It simply will not happen. Now, it is very possible that within the confines of the Samoan political system, and given the constraints of Samoan culture in general, that the forces of resistance, if you will, those who do not want to shift, may be able to prevail, at least over the short term. They can hark to nationalism. They can hark to continuity. They can claim that there are, they have claimed that there's all sorts of treasonous things going on. They can claim foreign interference of various sorts. But the truth is this. You don't have to be in any particular location to be sworn into office. I mean, they're trying to make the argument that the swearing in occurred outside of the parliament building, hence is invalid. That's a spurious allegation. They claimed that the decision-making leading to the swearing in was done on a Sunday, which is the Sabbath, and so that was, you know, treasonous against God. That also has no foundation in the Samoan Constitution. By the Samoan Constitution, the swearing-in ceremony was legal, and the new government of Samoa is the FAST party government. Now they're alleging that the Supreme Court justices were biased against the outgoing government. At that point, you get into Donald Trump-style politicking. You're now questioning the legitimacy, not just of the election process, which again, international election observers said it was fair, it was transparent, FAST won on the merits. What they're now trying to argue is against the legitimacy, not just the legality, the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. So it's possible that they cling on to power for a little more. But in terms of constitutional processes and legitimacy in the eyes of the world, the fast party government is the legitimate authority in Samoa. And the only thing, Selwyn, that I could see that would undermine this natural succession in the face of, quite frankly, this disloyal resistance is a foreign actor getting involved on behalf of the Human Rights Protection Party. And we'll leave aside the irony of the name of that particular party. Samoa is very vulnerable to foreign interference. I do agree with that.
There's been a lot of chatter in this respect relating to China's role in the Pacific and in this instance with Samoa.
Yeah, there's. Personally, I don't think the Chinese would be so foolish, as to overtly intervene in what is going on in Samoa. But you're right. There have been rumors that part of the resistance to handing over power involves Chinese influence and letting out contracts for infrastructure development, all that sort of stuff.
At the end of the day, Samoa is an independent Pacific Island state in its own right. So these outside influences, while they may have elements of cause amongst the chatter that's coming out there, the solutions remain within Samoa, don't they? What's fascinating here too, Paul, is for the audience's point of benefit, Samoa, for example, when there's been upheaval in the Pacific, we may have seen it at Pacific Island forums, but certainly when there's been military coups in Fiji, Samoa is often being the stabilizing state and nearby friend. Likewise, when there were upheavals in Tonga, where there's been rivalry between Samoa and Tonga, Samoa was a stable Pacific Island friend as those countries got back to normality. The irony here is that the criticisms that came across when a military coup happened in Fiji from the outgoing Prime Minister of Samoa, he seems to be acting in the same way. Now, I'm kind of thinking, what kind of imbalance does this cause amongst the Pacific Island fraternity, government fraternity, and certainly how it would be expressed within the Pacific Island Forum later this year?
Well, the interesting thing is that in the South Pacific, as elsewhere in the world, what we're seeing is, again, we're in this transitional moment where we're seeing the decline of aristocratic politics. So Samoa, which has always been a limited democracy, if that, the nobility in Samoa has a tremendous amount of influence, including in parliament. They're divided. There's a certain amount of seats reserved for nobles. There's a certain amount of seats reserved for commoners. Things that I think many people in the West, think of as a bygone era. Well, in Samoa it exists. In Tonga, we've got a full-fledged monarchy. But their influence is declining. The politics of nobility are declining. The reasons for that are many. And the measures they've taken to preserve their power are increasingly insufficient to stave off true democratization efforts. I'll give you an example. Both in Samoa and Tonga, Samoans and Tongans who live overseas, let's say here in New Zealand, of which there are many Tongans and Samoans, they cannot vote in their national elections. And the reason for that is that the nobilities in both instances know full well that once their people have been exposed to the democracies that are New Zealand, Australia, the United States, they're more than likely going to vote for change away from the noble-driven system. And so they've been excluded. Hundreds of thousands of Samoans and Tongans are excluded from the vote, what one might say is a birthright vote, through no fault of their own, because their leaders fear them. But even so, in Tonga, the opposition won. And I think it presages changes to come, not only there, but elsewhere. Fiji, we had a military authoritarian dictatorship. The dictator is now the civilian and democratically elected president of Fiji. Maybe what we're seeing in various shapes and forms and at different paces, the incremental move towards, if not full democracy as a political form, as an incremental move towards more openness and transparency in governance. And that gets to the PIF. Again, a very good angle is, you know, what do we do with a country that is now in the middle of a contested transition when it comes to regional governments? What signals are being emanated from Samoa, formerly a very stable place, now a very unstable place, to the partners in the region, which are not just Polynesian? I mean, they include Melanesian partners. It includes the French Polynesian partners. And so I think that that's where we were talking about foreign interference and the concerns about the Chinese. There's concerns about New Zealand and Australian interference as well. But I actually think, no, the influence, not interference, will be more subtle, and it will come in the form of the Pacific Island Forum encouraging Samoa to follow its true path, which in this instance would be rotation in government, and to urge the Human Rights Protection Party to understand a fundamental fact. In democracy, you agree to lose because you always get a chance to compete again. And I think that's where the authoritarianism in the Human Rights Protection Party is evident. They don't understand this is only for 3 years or so. And then you can come back and compete on equal terms. If the FAS party is a poor government, they'll be gone. Yeah. And you'll be back. And that, I think, is what the PIF can sell.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I would say, just in closing, Paul, thank you for that contribution on both of these major issues today. It may be by the time the Pacific Island Forum Leaders Summit occurs later this year in 2021 that Samoa has its first legitimately elected and accepted and celebrated woman prime minister. And that may be something that Samoa brings to the Pacific Island Forum, where it can shake the hands with other countries that have achieved the same, namely New Zealand, with new breed of politics that has come in the wake of those elections. That would be something to be worth celebrating. On that, Paul, thank you very much again for your contribution today and picking through the analysis and the events of the last 2 weeks. Until this time next week, we thank you to the audience. We look forward to your company once again round about midday next Thursday, New Zealand Standard Time. Until then, take care. We look forward to seeing you again. Goodbye.